welcome to Gaelic Sportscast, following friends and Gaelic sports action around the world. Gaelic Sportscast tonight brings you the concluding episode, part two, of our interview with former Antrim footballer and University of Ulster academic, Dr. Paul Darby, about his brilliant new book on the history of Gaelic games in America, entitled Gaelic Games, Nationalism, and the Irish Diaspora in the United States. We finished part one yesterday talking about one of the early Gaelic Games stadiums in America, Celtic Park in Queens, New York. So Celtic Park then was like that first, it was very important for the Irish Americans, and there was athletics meets and Gaelic football and hurling play there on a regular basis to huge crowds, I believe, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the time there were four clubs known as the Big Four, Cork, Kerry, Kildare and Kilkenny. And they were regularly drawing crowds of upwards of 10,000. And as a consequence, they actually were granted favourable terms for the use of the venue, so they were actually receiving better terms in terms of how much of the gate receipts they would actually receive than some of the other smaller clubs. And of course, this led to a lot of acrimony within the GAA at the time, so much so that the main governing body for Gaelic Games in New York at the time, the Irish Counties Athletic Union, actually acquired another venue in 1908, which was called Wakefield Park, based in Yonkers. Now, unfortunately, that venue closed after a couple of years, and the Irish Counties Athletic Union effectively lose control of the GAA, and that organisation was replaced in 1914 by another organisation called the GAA of the United States. But it continues to have a difficult relationship with the Big Four clubs. And eventually in 1915, the Big Four clubs actually split away from the main governing body for Gaelic Games in New York, although they do return a couple of years later.
Then we saw the start of the Irish tours to America. And I believe the first one was the All-Ireland Champions Kerry, and their tour on the East Coast in New York, and I think was it in Boston as well? That was 1927, was it?
Well, the first tour by an Irish team to the United States actually occurred in 1926, when the All-Ireland Hurling Champions, Tipperary, toured the Northeastern Seaboard. They played a number of games in New York. One of the games played at the Polo Grounds attracted an attendance of 30,000.
Wow.
And you know, those sorts of events were hugely significant in terms of the promotion of Gaelic games in the States, because you had Irish immigrants who had the opportunity to witness what was at the time the highest level of competition. So the 1926 tour was hugely successful, and that was followed the following year by the visit of the Kerry footballers, and they played three games. An aggregate attendance across the three games of 100,000 people, which is, of course, is a huge number.
Phenomenal.
But interestingly, the Kerry footballers didn't have it all their own way, and in fact, the New York All-Star Select actually won each of the three games, and that, I suppose, gives you an indication of the quality of the Gaelic football that was being played in the States at that time.
The New York team then, I believe, visited Ireland, didn't they, in relation to the Tailteann games, and there was a row broke out, which kind of started off, perhaps, the animosity between the GAA in Ireland and New York. You can correct me if I'm wrong here, but in preparation for the games in Ireland, they went training on a soccer ground in Ireland, or in Dublin, I suppose, and the GAA found out about it, and the tour was cancelled. Could you tell us about that?
Well, the first trip to Ireland by a visiting American team actually took place in as far back as 1924, when a New York hurling team represented America, if you like, at the Caldean Games. I think the incident that you're perhaps referring to took place sometime later. I think well into the 1930s. And of course there were problems with the tours. I mean, the tours brought the GAA at Croke Park and the GAA in the States into contact and indeed conflict with one another. While the tours in 1926 and 1927 were hugely successful, not least measured by the number of people who attended, cracks begin to appear in the relationship between the GAA at Croke Park and the GAA in the States, particularly in New York, because it begins to become clear that these games in 1926 and in 1927 were being organized by an American tour promoter, and ultimately that was to generate profit. And of course this conflicted with the amateur ethos of the GAA. There were also some rumors at the time that some of the players who were taking part in these games were actually being paid. So there were sort of very early on concerns that these tours were undermining the amateur ethos of the GAA. So that conflict then began to colour the relationship between Croke Park and the GAA in New York and in the States more generally. And then moving into the 1930s, when the tours continued, there was all sorts of acrimony around a range of issues, the scheduling of tours, the dates for games, the financial arrangements. And then things come to a head when an American touring team visited Ireland to play a game at Croke Park. And as part of their training, they couldn't get access to GAA facilities. They actually used a soccer ground, and of course this contravened one of the GAA's cardinal rules, if you like. So that certainly contributed to the conflict.
The 50s and the 60s was a golden era for Gaelic games in New York, and you had the towering figure of John Kerry O'Donnell, president, and also the leaseholder for Gaelic Park. He was often critical of the GAA and how they went about their affairs. And on page 122, he writes, as I understand it from my reading here in The Advocate, the Irish local journal in New York, he says, "The Central Council should shake itself up. There are far too many incompetents in it, too many people keeping seats warm. What is needed is people who are prepared to think and plan and do something for the players. Let the Central Council ease off with the talk of authority and discipline and give us cooperation and understanding and a desire to do things in harmony." So that kind of, I suppose, summed up the sentiment of a lot of people in New York at the time. And would you agree with that?
Well, certainly John Kerry O'Donnell was a hugely influential but also controversial figure in the history of the GAA in New York and certainly beyond. O'Donnell has been roundly criticised over the years, not only by GAA members in Ireland but also by local New York Gaels. For example, one of the criticisms that was levied against him was the argument that he was using Gaelic Park as a venue not to promote Gaelic games, but rather for his own personal financial gain. I'm not sure to what extent that is the case, but what I would say is that without John Kerry O'Donnell, the New York GAA certainly wouldn't be in the position that it's in today, because in 1946, the New York GAA were actually on the verge of losing the lease on what was then Innisfail Park, which subsequently became Gaelic Park. And this would have been potentially disastrous for the GAA in New York, but John Kerry O'Donnell, who owned a couple of bars and saloons in New York at the time, he stepped in and acquired the lease and becomes the sole proprietor. And from that time period, he becomes a hugely influential figure in the GAA. Now, he develops quite an adversarial relationship with Croke Park, as is exemplified in that quote that you've just read. And I think one of the main reasons for the conflict between John Kerry O'Donnell and Croke Park was the fact that Kerry O'Donnell adopted a very modern business-oriented approach to the GAA and the promotion of the GAA in New York, and of course that conflicted with some of the more conservative traditionalist elements of the GAA in Ireland. Central Council in Ireland, of course, were also annoyed at this sort of commercial approach that O'Donnell adopted. They didn't like the fact that alcohol was sold at Gaelic Park. They didn't like the fact that Gaelic games were being sponsored by liquor companies and by cigarette firms. They didn't think that was particularly appropriate. But John Kerry O'Donnell certainly gave as good as he got.
To some extent, he was Americanizing the games in that he was bringing sponsors on board and so forth. And I think that the GAA in Ireland weren't really ready for that.
I think that's a fair comment, Dennis. He himself, I think, had clearly become Americanized. He was essentially, first and foremost, he was an Irish immigrant, and he obviously had a love for all things Irish. But he had obviously lived in America for a long time. He had run successful businesses in America. And I think all of that had an influence on the way that he saw the GAA and on his vision about how the GAA should develop. But of course, his vision wasn't the same vision that was shared in Ireland at the time, that perhaps wasn't as progressive or modern or forward thinking as certainly as O'Donnell was.
We just talk about how important a place was the likes of Gaelic Park and the Bronx to the Irish there. As a former immigrant myself, both in New York and in Boston, a place like that does give you, I suppose, a sense of your Irish identity. When you see Gaelic football and hurling played there, I was never there. I never saw it in Gaelic Park. I was in Canton quite a lot every Sunday in Boston. And it almost feels like you're in Ireland for the day when you go there. Did you get sense of that in your search?
Absolutely. Not only did I get a sense of it in my research, I also got a very strong sense of it on a personal level. As I said to you right at the start of our conversation, when I moved to Liverpool, I found myself, although it was a 30-minute flight away from Belfast, it was...
Could
have been 5,000 miles away, and I had the chance to play Gaelic football in Birmingham, and to make a 3 or 4 hour car journey down the M6, which wasn't particularly enjoyable. But as soon as you went through the gates of Park na HÉireann, it just resonated of home. You heard accents. You went into the clubhouse. You were able to, even simple things like being able to buy Club Orange and potato crisps and all of that sort of stupid stuff, what was significant in terms of helping people to recapture a sense of their Irishness. And that has historically undoubtedly been the case with Gaelic Park and the Bronx. I mean, I've spoken to a number of GAA officials, had countless conversations with GAA players and spectators in New York and indeed further afield in the States. And they all say the same thing in terms of their motivation for being involved in Gaelic games. It's a taste of home. It allows them to reconnect with the place and the space that they moved from.
Yes, and as we're conducting this conversation today on St. Patrick's Day, Day of Days for the Irish around the world, and particularly in America, where so many Irish immigrants left to land on the shores of the United States. It's particularly poignant that that these places like Celtic Park and Gaelic Park and Canton in Boston and Gaelic Park in Chicago, Park na Gael in San Francisco, these places play a huge role in the quality of life, I suppose, of people living there. And your work, your book, highlights that, and it's in the history that you will see of Irish America on the bookshelves of libraries in the States, you will find reference to the Kennedys and like Boss Tweeds, the labor bosses in New York and Boston, and famine immigrants and that type of stuff. But little or nothing about Gaelic games and its role in the people's and the Irish immigrants' lives in America. So you're basically shining a light on how important places like Gaelic Park was for Irish immigrants there. And that has really been kept out of the history up to now.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, that was one of my kind of key motivating factors that sort of kept me going and the sort of, you know, the dark days when you're sitting in New York Public Library, you know, sifting through archives and newspaper reports, and you're maybe coming away at the end of an 8-hour shift with, you know, a couple of excerpts or a couple of dates that you could maybe use. You know, it's the fact that Gaelic games, certainly for the people that I spoke to, have been absolutely fundamental in their lives and allowing them to adjust to living in a foreign land, and I just felt that it was necessary to redress the neglect of Gaelic games and the GAA more generally in the broader historiography of the Irish in America.
Getting back to the tours now, how important were the tours in helping Gaelic games in the States? And like the likes of the All-Ireland football final in the Polo Grounds in 1947, like that. And then the subsequent tours in 1960s and 70s. How important were they in helping to grow the game in the States?
Well, the tours of Irish teams to the United States, which as I said earlier, you know, stretch back to 1926, and have taken place intermittently since then, have been hugely significant in terms of the development of Gaelic games at various periods. For example, during the Great Depression era of the 1930s, when there was dwindling interest in the sort of local club game in New York and Boston and Chicago, San Francisco, the tours really, you know, kept the games alive to a large degree. So they certainly played an important role into the 1950s as well. I mean, the New York board are granted admittance into the National League competition in 1950, and this is absolutely fundamental in terms of reviving Gaelic games in the city in the aftermath of the Second World War. You see the establishment of the All-Stars Tours then in 1975. And of course, what these occasions provided was an opportunity for Irish people to come together, to converse with one another, to catch up with old friends, to catch up with stories from home, and also, of course, to witness really high-level Gaelic games. And this was influential in terms of the development of the games in the States.
And of course, the Immigration Act of 1965 didn't help Gaelic games growth as well. And I mean, over, you know, from 1900 to, you know, to 2000, that 100-year period, I mean, you've had two world wars, the Great Depression, and then this 1965 Act. So, I mean, it's been up and down as regards the immigration levels to America, which seem to affect the sustainability of Gaelic clubs across the states. Would you say that clubs at that time were over-dependent on an immigration model, and that a criticism often thrown by the GAA in Ireland, I suppose, at various times throughout the history in the States, is that that they should do more development at underage, which they are doing now?
Yeah, well, clearly Gaelic games in the States have, to a large degree, been dependent on rates of Irish immigration. There have been periods, of course, where Irish immigration has been strong, and this has reflected positively in terms of the number of clubs that have developed in the States. I suppose up until very recently, the GAA in America hasn't been particularly progressive in terms of the promotion of Gaelic games amongst young Irish Americans. Although that said, it should of course be noted that at various stages, for example, in the aftermath of the 1965 Immigration Act, you know, into the 1970s, there were a number of influential GAA figures across the states who initiated what became quite successful youth programs. However, once immigration rates began to increase again, enthusiasm for these youth programs began to dwindle. And I just get the sense that certainly up until more recently, the GAA historically in the states didn't really see through the youth policies. Maybe they felt that if they persevered with Irish American youth, that the standard of the game wouldn't be as capable. I think the other issue that fed into this, of course, was the fact that many clubs were supported by quite wealthy Irish American benefactors, and they were keen to see their investment in a particular club being rewarded by end of season honours. You know, they wanted bragging rights for winning championships, and I suppose some of those individuals didn't really have the patience to see the youth programs fully come to fruition. But I think that certainly began to change moving into the 1990s. Immigration in that decade, of course, dwindled significantly on the back of the progress of the Celtic Tiger. And what you see in that period, particularly in San Francisco, was the development of a much more sustained movement for youth programs. I'm thinking specifically about the work of John O'Flynn in San Francisco, who established the Irish Football Youth League in 1994. And that youth league has since gone from strength to strength. Of course, in the aftermath of 9/11 and the impact that has had on rates of immigration, you have seen obviously a much more progressive push for youth development, and increasingly clubs and the various governing bodies, divisional boards, see the development of Gaelic games amongst youth players as the future of Gaelic games.
Well, Paul, your work is a fascinating book. And it is groundbreaking in its detail and in its uncovering of the detailed history of Gaelic games in New York, Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. We could spend a lot more time talking about the actual detailed historical events throughout the last 150 years, but your book is called Gaelic Games, Nationalism, and the Irish Diaspora in the United States. And it is available in bookshelves in Ireland, and I believe recently available now in America. Is that right?
It is indeed. I mean, I suppose probably the best place to acquire the book for those in Europe and Ireland would be through the publisher itself. The website is www.ucdpress.ie. And then you just follow the links through to the book itself. Alternatively, I think online bookshops like Amazon, certainly in Europe and also in the United States, also stock the book, so it can also be purchased.
Yeah. Did you say that it was on the bookshelves in America?
Yeah, it came out in February in the States. I'm not sure which bookstores actually will carry it, but if somebody is interested in acquiring a copy, probably the best thing to do would be to contact the publisher, ucdpress.ie.
Well, it's a monumental work, brilliantly researched, and excellent book, and it is basically the quintessential history of the Gaelic Games in America. Any Gaelic Games enthusiast in America, I think, should have a copy. Thank you very much, Paul. For joining Gaelic Sportscast today. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Dennis.
The book is entitled Gaelic Games, Nationalism, and the Irish Diaspora in the United States. It is brilliantly researched, And at every page you turn, it is clear the author has a passion for the subject. The work should be required reading for every Gaelic Games enthusiast in America and beyond. Music written by John McCartan and performed by John McCartan and Lunasa.